There was another guy called, I think his name was Flack, George Flack, I think. He was a West Country man. I don't know exactly where, but he was younger than Fred and old Tom. I would have guessed him, I suppose, probably 50-ish. But when you're only 16, they all look pensioners anyway. But he was a nice guy too, and they sort of alternated and shifted, Fred and George Flack. There was another guy came called Harold Ellis, who was quite a keen gardener. And I do believe that Harold Ellis had a nasty accident in the yard at Woodlesford some years later and lost a foot. And the story goes, I wasn't there at the time, but the story goes that he crawled a lot of the way back from where the accident happened back to the station before they took him off to the hospital. But he did have, they did patch him up and he had a prosthesis put on, and I gather he worked at the station for some considerable time after that.
Tell me more about Dennis Wagstaff, and because he was this little chap that worked with you. What kind of adventures did you get up to?
We were always up to no good. Wagstaff was a real a wag by name and wag by nature, and we'd have fish and chips at lunchtime, and he was a great brown sauce fan. His favourite was Titbit sauce. He'd buy a sixpenny bottle of Titbit sauce, and with one fell swoop, he'd whack the bottom of the bottle and pour the entire contents on his fish and chips. And he'd do that every day, a whole bottle of sauce. And the guy was only tiny. I don't know how big he was, but he was much, much shorter than me. I don't think he was above 5 feet tall. And he weighed nothing. He was in the breeze. I used to hold him upside down by his ankles from signal gantries and on platforms to take photographs. You know, amazing.
Fish and chips tasted better then, didn't they?
Oh, fish and chips were wonderful. There was a fish shop on the high street in Woodlesford to die for. We used to have fish and chips almost every day.
Tell me more about working in the booking office then. Tell me about the tickets and the kind of places that people used to go to.
Tickets were... They had printed tickets for most of the local stuff to Leeds and Wakefield and Normanton and what have you. It was when people wanted to go to more distant points. If they were going on holidays down to Devon or Cornwall, you had to write the ticket out by hand with an ink pen. And tickets were about an inch and a half long and probably an inch wide, a card ticket. And you could get singles or returns. The return ticket had two halves to it. And you had to put it in the ticket press to imprint the date on the back of the ticket when it was issued. And it was a manual ticket press. My goodness. You had to hit it hard with the card ticket to impress it on the date on the back of the ticket. And if you got your thumb in the printer, oof, it would go black and you'd lose. Oh, you could always tell a trainee booking clerk, they all had no thumbnail on. The thumbnail was always off. And when they got experience, you could see the difference between somebody who could use a ticket press well, turning a ticket round, because you had to do both ends. And if you didn't break your nail on the first end, you'd break it on the second end.
And what about changing the date on those things? How did you do that?
Yeah, do that. You had to open the machine out and get a pin and turn. It was like a brass revolving date thing, and you turn the dates round. And I mean, it was manually done, so you could put any date on you wanted.
How did you cope with all the people who were coming to catch the early morning trains into Leeds?
Well, if you were smart, you'd have return tickets already printed. I'd take them out of the machine. I'd take a dozen out, and I'd. Stamp them with the date on already, and I'd have the change. I don't know how much the fares was at that time, but people would give you a half a crown or 2 shillings or something, and I'd have the change ready in little piles so that if somebody came along and wanted to return to Leeds, I had the ticket already printed, throw it through the window, and if they gave you a 2 shillings, half a crown or a 10 bob note, I had the change all ready for them, and you could whip it out very quickly, because you had to be quick. Because there'd be nobody there most of the time. And then within 2 minutes of the train coming, 100 people show up and they all want a ticket and they all want the change and they all want to discuss the weather and know what time the trains are coming back, you know.
I remember people coming in through the station gate as the train was just arriving. And they'd have to run and get their ticket and then get on the train. And the train would be held for them while they did that.
Well, yeah, that times were different then. I'm sure you couldn't get away with that now, but people did do that. They were late for trains, and they did hold them and stop trains on occasions for people to help them out.
Coal was a big thing then, wasn't it? I mean, there was coal everywhere.
Coal was... It's amazing to think how expensive coal is nowadays. And yet at that time, all around the yard, in the sidings, by signal boxes, by back of the station, there was mountains of coal. There was as much coal as you could possibly want. I'm amazed that people that worked on the station didn't take the coal home for their own coal fires. But I honestly think people didn't do that. But there was lots and lots of coal about, and really high quality, big, chunky, shiny coal, not this nasty, slaggy stuff that you see nowadays.
Tell me more about that gardening aspect of it. Where was the garden?
Well, the it was on the side from going towards Normanton. That was where it all started, because they used to have a fairly poor garden at both sides at Woodlesford. But somebody decided that it'd be a great idea to go in for the best garden competition on the station. And Harold Ellis said, well, yeah, let's see if we can do that. I'm happy to do some digging. And I think old Fred had some budgerigars, or he was going to build an aviary or something there. And so it all started. Everybody took an interest. All the passengers and things took an interest in the station gardens. And it actually was quite magnificent. And I'm sure they certainly came as runner-up if they didn't win it. But I think that they won the best garden in the area, certainly 1 or 2 years. And it was a thing that held the whole station people together. You know, they all worked hard at it. Even the plate layers, who were not necessarily attached to Woodlesford Station. I mean, they worked through there. Can't remember what the plate layers were called. Peter something was the head ganger, I think. But they were a good team of guys too. They had a cabin in the yard at Woodlesford, and we could go in there and have a sneaky cup of tea and stuff until it burnt down one day. That was the only time in my life I ever used a fire extinguisher. We had to try and put the wooden cabin out. I mean, the thing burnt to the ground anyway. But
where was that?
That was in the yard on the at Woodlesford station by the old dock where... there was a line, a siding in there, and it was at the side of that. It was a wooden cabin that they had all their tools in, and they used to make the tea and what have you.
There was another cabin.
Ah, now you're talking.
Around the back of the station.
You're talking about the bug hut.
The what?
The bug hut, as it was known, or bug hut. It was the place where all the station staff had their lunches. Wonderful green, solid-built wooden cabin, a real railway antique was that, 2-inch thick timber. It was a huge place with a pot-bellied stove in it. And we used to sit in there and have fish and chips and sandwiches every day. Wonderful. There was an old guy called Sess. I don't know what Sess did. I think it's something to do with the colliery. He was only a small chap, and he had a little Yorkshire Terrier, a filthy, dirty thing on a piece of string. And he always had a 12-bore shotgun under his arm. And he used to come across the station and he'd talk to people, and he said, "There's got rats underneath that hut." And so it was decided that they would try and get this place free of rats. I mean, I'd never seen the rats, but Sess was absolutely sure the place was infested with rats. And so they got the gangers to bring the jacks that they used to lift the line. They put the jack under each corner of this cabin, and they started jacking it up. And Sess is there with his 12-bore shotgun and the little Yorkshire Terrier. And suddenly, rats start coming out in every bloody direction. And Sess, he shoots the gun, and the rats run like hell. And then he gets hold of the dog, and he throws the dog, poor little thing, he throws it underneath the wooden hut. And there's all kinds of screeching and whining. And the dog comes out, and a rat's bit its nose at the end. But my goodness, it's got it. It's got the rat by its neck, and the rat's bigger than the dog. And they were running up. There was a tree on the top of the embankment, and the rat ran up the tree, and Sess shot it with a 12-bore shotgun. It was like the Wild West. But that was a magical hut, was the bug hut. Everybody used to spend as much time in there as possible. And, of course, smoking was allowed then, and in the winter when the pot-bellied stove was going, it'd be 95 degrees in the cabin and everybody smoking. It was a real den of iniquity.
You mentioned the rats. What about the pigeons?
Oh, pigeons, yeah. Pigeons, I'd never had anything to do with racing pigeons, but Woodlesford obviously was a great mining area, and it's, it seems to be a keen pastime of miners to breed racing pigeons. And besides sending racing pigeons away for training, they each week people used to, miners used to come with a basket with a half a dozen pigeons in and send it somewhere in the country and with an order to release the pigeons when it got there. And occasionally at Woodlesford, we'd get the local racing club would get hundreds and hundreds of boxes or baskets, as they were, wicker baskets of pigeons. And we had to get all these pigeons together on the get them on the downside or the side of the line going towards Leeds on here, and we would pull out the there's a bar that goes through the front of the basket, and as you pull them, the doors open on the baskets, and a million pigeons come out, and they fly round three times to the pigeons before they set off in the direction of home. It's a strange thing, but it was lots of fun letting the pigeons loose.
And they'd all arrived on a train earlier in the day.
Yeah, they'd arrive on trains from all over during the course of the day, and we'd stack them all up together, and we'd be instructed to let them go at a specific time, because when they get to the other end, there's obviously they have a pigeon timing clock, and they put their the leg of the pigeon, it has a band round it, and they clock it in. So we had to let them go at an exact time, you know, 7 o'clock at night, let these pigeons go.
Do you remember how far away they came from, the names of the places?
I can't remember the names of the places, but some of them were an awful long way. Some of the pigeons on training, they used to send them abroad. They used to send them into Brittany and Normandy to fly back to Woodlesford. I mean, I'm not an expert on it, but they were very avid flyers of pigeons were the guys there at the time.
And what happened to the empty baskets?
Oh, empty baskets went back. I think that was part of the deal on British Rail at that time, that you paid for your pigeon sending to Ouagadougou or wherever, and the basket came back automatically. It had a tag on it, and it came back. But things that used to be sent on the railway then, they didn't need to be in containers. I mean, you'd get hares and rabbits, half a dozen rabbits, all tied together with a piece of string with a label on, and people would just send them that way, you know, without... And pheasants, you'd get two or three pheasants together with a label on, Mrs. Brown, Acacia Avenue, you know.